It is 7:09 in the morning. You're listening to Upfront. My name is Brian Edwards Tiegert. Thank you so much to all of you who pledged during our fund drive last week. We did end on time. We did end on time after taking, I think, a record-breaking 4 days off for live broadcasts of various proceedings, including in the Senate. And as a consequence, we also finished about $37,000 short of our goal. But you can still help. You can pledge online at kpfa.org, particularly if you liked those live broadcasts during the fund drive. Show your support. And I will mention that in the intervening weekend, since we closed the official fund drive proceedings, we have also closed nearly $10,000 of our gap. So help close the rest. www.kpfa.org. We've got 28 days, exactly 4 weeks to go until midterm elections. And since we didn't get a chance to do Mondays with Mitch yesterday, we had the hour off for KPFA's annual broadcast from Alcatraz Island. We moved Mondays with Mitch this week to Tuesday. Mitch Jezerich, host of Letters and Politics, thank you for joining us in studio.
I'm a little concerned about the framing of Mondays with Mitch. You know, it's not a very popular day, and it reminds me almost of that ringtone that you really like. You know, you're like, oh, that sounds nice. Let me set it as my alarm. I would like waking up to this. And then in a few days, you hate it. So, I don't know. I'm a little concerned about Mondays. It would be like calling this show the 7 a.m. alarm clock with Brian Edwards Tiegert.
Yeah, it kind of does to us what Clockwork Orange did to Ludwig von Beethoven.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well said. Touche. Good morning.
Good morning. National politics. Last time you and I were in the studio, the Senate was barreling towards its confirmation of Brett Kavanaugh in the intervening days. The Senate vote happened, 50-48. Kavanaugh has been sworn in. Donald Trump has been publicly apologizing to him because clearly he's the one who needs an apology. I wanted to take a few minutes this morning to talk about what now. So the first question is, there's this framing in liberal and left America that this is kind of a earth-moving shift in the nature of the Supreme Court to confirm someone who was openly partisan during his confirmation proceedings, and someone who has all the asterisks hanging next to his name associated with the sexual assault allegations that came up in the final weeks of his confirmation, and also to cement a Supreme Court majority that's probably ideologically at odds with the sentiment of the majority of the American public. What do you think? Give us some historic perspective. Tell me it's not that bad.
Brian, it's not that bad. Everybody calm down. It's not that good either. I mean, how far has this shift happened in the Supreme Court? I think it's arguable. I do think the court likely, though we'll have to see how things play out, has moved more to the right. But it was already towards the right. You know, Anthony Kennedy as a swing vote did not swing very often when he voted. He did on gay, lesbian, transgender rights issues. He did on, you know, he was a wavering vote, but he ended up siding with the liberal making it a majority over the Hellerstadt case in Texas that threatened to close half of abortion clinics in the state. So on those issues, yeah. But on so many issues, he is very much to the right. You'll remember he was not the swing vote when it came to upholding the constitutionality, for example, of the Affordable Care Act. That was John Roberts. So the thing with Anthony Kennedy was a conservative jurist. He just happened to be probably the one who is more towards the middle than the other four. I think Kavanaugh probably will end up taking it farther to the right, and it presents an interesting dynamic. So, you know, it was one conservative, probably more conservative, replacing another little less conservative. So you still have the 5-4 split on the Supreme Court. I think in a strange way, people that are concerned about the court going to the right should hope for good health for Clarence Thomas in the next 2 years, because if they were to replace Clarence Thomas, and he's not that old, actually, he's just 70 years of age. I mean, he conceivably could serve on the court for another 10, 15 years, if not more. But if they were to somehow, if he were to resign now, and leave his seat, which I doubt he would do, and I don't think he's one who's likely to give in to pressure. Nominating another young conservative to replace him would be pretty dramatic move. But even as it is, I think Republicans have ensured that they are going to have a majority on the court now for the next 5 to 10, maybe even 15 years, and, you know, potentially longer, depending who's the president at the time. I mean, just imagine if Hillary Clinton, I guess elections do matter. If Hillary Clinton was president, then very likely it would be 6-3 in the other way now. That if Anthony Kennedy would retire under those circumstances, and we'd probably be looking at a red wave election rather than a blue wave.
Right. And to be fair, if Hillary Clinton were still president and Mitch McConnell were still running the Senate, we might still be looking at a 4-4 Supreme Court.
Yeah, I don't know if they would have held it open for an entire term, but maybe. I think, you know, what Mitch McConnell did is really important to remember by holding open and not even allowing a confirmation hearing for Merrick Garland. And it shouldn't be just seen as the past. I think it very much is connected to what is happening today. In fact, I think this whole dynamic with the Supreme Court is very much in line with other approaches from Republicans when it goes towards recognizing that they may be a permanent minority party in this country as demographics change and people change, into one that is trying to shape the political and legal institutions in order to favor them. I think this whole, what we just witnessed with the Supreme Court, is very much in line with the Republican strategy over redistricting and gerrymandering, over voter suppression, and now this as well, to ensure that they still have, you know, that they still have a lot of leverage when it comes to the political institutions. Even the vote for Kavanaugh, they were looking at population per state. And if you were to take the population per state with each senator, a minority approved the nomination of Brett Kavanaugh.
So the votes in favor of the Kavanaugh confirmation represent a combined total of 143 million Americans. The votes against the confirmation of Brett Kavanaugh represent a combined total of 181 million Americans. Now, that's just kind of the Senate, right? And, you know, it was not set up to be a Democratic body. It is not, structurally speaking, a Democratic body. And as the U.S. population goes through this grand sorting process where more and more people who are predisposed to liberal, democratic-ish politics move from wherever they started life to urban metropolises that tend to be coastal and have pretty good professional job prospects, that's going to get worse, kind of the gap between popular sentiment and what voting outcomes actually are in the Senate. The other thing it means, which I think is worth thinking about for a minute, is that the only path Democrats have to a Senate majority for years to come will count on basically having Democrats like Joe Manchin who represent Republican states in their caucus.
That's right.
And those are very unreliable votes.
That's right. And but at this point, are you more concerned about how the votes go, or are you more concerned about who has the majority, who then fills all the important seats in the Senate? Right. So I think that's why Democrats are not going to throw Joe Manchin out of the party. They need people like him. They need people like Heidi Heitkamp, I think, in order to even have a chance of having a majority in the Senate. And then once you have that majority in the Senate, you control the agenda. Your members they'll probably give Joe Manchin, just to keep him in the caucus, some type of chair, but chairship of a committee. But, you know, it won't be Judiciary Committee. It won't be Armed Services Committee, probably. It won't be any of the Appropriations Committee. You know, it'll be one of these committees that people don't pay. That may be important, but probably don't pay as much attention to. Probably a committee that would be important for his own state of West Virginia. So
that's assuming he holds on to his seat and Democrats pick up a majority in the Senate, which is not looking terribly likely now. The hot take from political analysts and pollsters seems to be that Kavanaugh's confirmation battle has had contradictory impacts on the race, that in the House, it has mobilized people, particularly suburban women, who have increased the likelihood of Democrats taking a majority in the House. And in the Senate, it has mobilized people, particularly Republicans, who are showing a steep increase in enthusiasm about voting, who have made it more likelihood that Republicans maintain their control of the Senate. So I guess the question it all leads to, and this is the one I saw bubbling across social media over the weekend, was kind of like, what next? Do Democrats just let that one go and say we fought the good fight? Do they make resuming the investigation of Brett Kavanaugh and whether he was truthful in his testimony under oath a priority if they take a majority in the House and have subpoena power? Do they press forward with an attempt at impeaching him? What do you think?
Who knows? Now, if the election were today and a new Congress were to be sworn in later in the week, then I would say they probably do pursue all these things. But that's hard to know what's going to happen, not just a month from now when the election is over, but what happens when the new Congress comes in January. So it's hard to know. I know people are talking about impeachment. You can impeach a Supreme Court justice. In fact, you can impeach any federal judge. Very unlikely it's going to happen. Even if you do have the majority in the Senate, as you pointed out, it's going to be very hard to do. But even if you do, you're not going to have the two-thirds majority that you need in order to impeach. And there's only been one impeachment of a sitting Supreme Court justice, and that was Samuel Chase in the early 1800s. And it was all political. It was because he was a Federalist. And actually, the move to impeach him was driven by Thomas Jefferson at the time. He was impeached in the House of Representatives, but they did not convict him in the Senate. It's the same process as you would do for a president. So he was not removed from office. No sitting Supreme Court justice has ever been removed from office through impeachment, even though you have had lower court judges who were impeached and convicted and removed from office. So it's a possibility. The process is a possibility. The Democrats in the House of Representatives, if they take over the leadership, Gerald Nadler, who's in line to be the next chair of the House Judiciary Committee, said over the weekend that they would continue the investigations of these allegations at Brett Kavanaugh. We'll have to see what comes out of that. I imagine we're going to see all kinds of investigations coming if the House is ruled by the Democrats in the next session, including over the bombshell of Donald Trump and his family use of the tax system in order to save a lot of money over the years will probably be investigated, because the House does have the subpoena ability to be able to get his tax records.
Yeah.
There's
a story that disappeared into the news cycle.
Well, when was the last time you heard about the Mueller investigation, right? I mean, I feel like I'm still recovering from this past month. Not that I did any of the real work, but it's been a dramatic past month that we have witnessed. And I think in moving forward, and you talked about, Brian, the enthusiasm gap isn't as big between Democrats and Republicans after, in the latest polling, after we saw happen with the Kavanaugh hearings as it was before.
And we should be clear, the enthusiasm is a measurement pollsters use. They'll typically ask people during polls things like, how important is it to you to vote in the upcoming election? How important is it to you that your party win a majority in the upcoming election? Kind of assessing not just what people's political preferences are, but trying to get at what the likelihood is of they're actually taking the trouble to go to the polls and cast a vote on election day, which is slightly different from a likely voter screen.
Yeah. And so I think what the Republicans are doing with this, I know this is what they're trying to do. They're trying to take all the drama that we saw the last month and play this silent majority playbook, which may not be a majority anymore. But as we have talked earlier, you don't quite need a majority anymore for the way that the system has been massaged over the years. And so I think they're trying to play on this. And it's a strong talking point. If you ever watch Fox News, you hear it often or pay attention to conservative media, is that what the left is doing is they try to smear and publicly destroy the character of somebody. They call people racist. They call people misogynist. They call people rapists, all these things without hard evidence to say that it is, that the left has thrown out the issues of due process and innocent until proven guilty and these type of things. And basically, as I said, you even heard it from Mitch McConnell over the weekend, has turned into a mob. And I think it's a playbook that goes back to Richard Nixon in 1968 after the anti-Vietnam War protest and also the uprisings that occurred through cities throughout the country. I think it was in 2016 happened as well. And I don't think it was a silent majority. I think it was a silent minority. But again, reactions to such things as, an Obama presidency, but then you also had Occupy Wall Street movement, you had Black Lives Matter movement. And I think they're going to try to take this idea of a silent majority, again, which I would call now a silent minority, and hoping that would galvanize their base to go and vote in November.
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable to see a party that has firm control over the presidency, the Congress, and now the Supreme Court try to cast itself in the victim role. But that's been something rhetorically that Donald Trump's been very successful at doing. And Brett Kavanaugh's testimony at the final hearing a week and a half ago made it clear that that was the kind of discursive strategy they were adopting for this confirmation battle. Make him the victim of the process, just kind of ignore the testimony that had come from his accuser. Nobody actually questioned its veracity. They just didn't spend any time at it, talked right past it. Brett Kavanaugh's the real victim here. And by extension, all men are the victims. Which I just have to say is like beyond cynical. It's kind of scary to me. Particularly thinking about how the rhetoric coming out of the manosphere on the internet, the places where this is kind of actually taken root and developed as an ideology, has driven violent people to commit mass shootings in this country. Anyway, Ms. Jesrich, it's always good to talk to you. What do you got coming up on your show at 10 o'clock today?
Brian, I just woke up. You're going to have to give me a couple hours for that. That was quite a that was pretty much quite a month that occurred this last month. So I actually took the weekend off. I have 2.5 hours to figure out what we're going to do at 10 a.m.
Fair enough. Coming up on our show, we're going to start our local elections countdown. We will be joined in studio by two candidates running in the assembly race in the state that is the best financed of any Democrat on Democrat battle. We'll speak to Buffy Wicks and Jovanka Beckles about their contrasting visions for Assembly District 15. But before we move on to that, just want to ask for your help. As I mentioned at the outset of the program, when we wrapped our fund drive on time at 7 o'clock on Friday, we also wrapped it up about $37,000 short of our goal. Kind of knew we were going to come up short. We had taken the better part of a day off to broadcast from the She the People convention in San Francisco, to broadcast the day of testimony from the Senate Judiciary Committee when Brett Kavanaugh and Christine Blasey Ford came to testify. The following day of deliberations, debate, and voting in Senate Judiciary, as it turns out, had a lot of twists and turns, and we were the only broadcaster in the Bay Area covering. And then finally, on the final day of Fund Drive, when the stakes could not be higher for a bottom line, broadcast live from the Senate floor. Thought this was an incredibly important moment in history to be doing so and to be bringing you the kind of reaction and analysis that only KPFA can. But what we also did was took a lot of the airtime away from our Fund Drive that we would normally use just like pounding the phone number and asking people to give money to the station. So what we're trying to do now is just make up a little bit of that ground by making very brief appeals to you over the course of the week in the space of 1 or 2 minutes instead of 15 or 20 to give through our website, www.kpfa.org. For a very limited time, we will have all the thank you gifts from the Fund Drive available there. We've just overhauled our web pledging form, so it is super easy to give at www.kpfa.org. And you can send a note when you put in that pledge. And particularly if you appreciated the coverage of the Supreme Court process, A lot of people here just poured time into making it happen, really going above and beyond, including our producer, Corinne Smith, Mitch Jezerich, and just like send a note saying you appreciated that, because it sends important signals to the decision makers here about what we put on the air and when we preempt our schedule, about how much listener support there is for that type of broadcasting. Again, that's www.kpfa.org.